talking about your how the University of Chicago didn't pan out, how it wasn't scholarly enough, and you were talking about functioning as a kind of anesthetist for dog operations.
Well, that explained how I picked my thesis, and that was important because it wasn't the thing that Dr. Mendel suggested, and it was in the view of other people who had urged me to come to Yale. It was unthinkable that I would choose anything except what Dr. Mendel. And so I think that I probably interfered with my relations to Dr. Mendel, because he was shocked also that what he had suggested wasn't the thing that I had taken. Of course, Dr. Mendel was a very sour individual the first year that you knew him. He just deliberately, well, Miss Marlatt was the same way, very sour for the first year. And Dr. Mendel regularly assigned to some of these important heads of departments that came to him for a PhD and go back to their home economics department. And he used to assign them something that you couldn't do. They could get technique, they could strive, they could organize, but he very often, midway, changed the topic to something that was within their grasp. So he was that sort, but he was just definitely sour. He would stop by my desk and he'd say the most crabbed things, criticizing anything that was he could fix on that was a criticism of me and my work. It didn't bother me. I'd gone through years of the same with Miss Marlette. She was a warm-hearted, crabby individual. Everybody was scared to death of her. And so I'd gone through years of not minding that. Why, it didn't bother me at all. But I realized afterward that not taking my thesis with him was kind of unforgivable and increased this. So that was that year, that first year, I think, was at the root of Dr. Steenbach's having spent 1 year with him and departing, wiping the dust from his feet of Yale, never forgiven. So I think that Dr. Steenbach didn't have the same philosophy of enduring that I had. So because then when I realized that I really had sort of queered things with Dr. Mendel and what should I do, there was a convention there at New Haven, so I took Dr. Steenbach aside when he came to the convention and asked his advice, and he said that I certainly should have accepted whatever Dr. Mendel offered me, but that since I had started on this other, just to keep ahead and to not mind anything and to get on peacefully with Dr. Mendel. It showed that fundamentally he didn't still resent Dr. Mendel as he did openly. He fundamentally didn't really. So that was an interesting sidelight on his relationship to Dr. Mendel. But then at the end of that first year, I got a very nice fellowship given to me from AAUW. And then Dr. Mendel's attitude completely changed. He remembered how Dr. Steenbach had wiped the dust of Yale off his feet, and he thought surely I would take that fellowship and go to Columbia or somewhere where my path was easier. So, oh my, how his attitude changed. He invited me to his house. His dinners were quite famous. He had a very good cook, and his dinners were quite famous, and he always invited his staff or graduate students by telegram. He would phone down to the telegraph office. They were supposed to know everything about where anybody was. So I got a telegram inviting me to a dinner, and I was deferred to. I was approached in the friendliest way. My jaw dropped to see Dr. Mendel as friendly as that, but it continued. He was very helpful then. From then on, he was very mild and helpful. Why, I had no idea of leaving Yale at the end of the first year. I could stick it out even if he continued his meanness to me. That didn't bother me. But it was really very nice to see another side to him. And then during that second year, Dr. Smith had to go on an extended vacation. I think he went abroad probably, but anyway, it was quite extended. So that Dr. Mendel took over. And by that time, I had my data pretty well in hand. But he immediately, to my great consternation, he immediately picked my results to pieces. "That doesn't prove anything," he said. "You added a protein that was different in phosphorus content from what you ran as supposedly a control for your experiment. You can't do things like that." He was quite right, but I didn't know how. He said, "You go repeat this all over again and choose your make an assay of the protein and the phosphorus in those two protein sources, then build up the non-phosphorus one with added phosphorus." Oh, it was quite right, but I didn't know. I never had learned how to do phosphorus determinations.
Well, who had you been? You had been working with Dr. Smith.
Yes, he's the one that had the operations with dogs and
so
on, and I joined his with great thrill to do these operations on my rats. And so that's why I didn't choose Dr. Mendel.
Yeah, no.
But here I come to Dr. Mendel as my chief major professor now with Dr. Smith off the campus. Here Dr. Mendel becomes my professor and criticizes what I've done so far.
Well, how come nobody else had seen that that flaw before Dr. Mendel?
Had seen what?
In other words, how come nobody else had pointed out that same problem with the phosphorus before Dr. Mendel?
Well, Dr. Smith should have, but Dr. Smith wasn't as good a researcher. He ventured into a different kind of subject matter, and he was all right, but he was no scholar. Mm-hmm. He then went to a Michigan university and rose in the ranks there and became a head of his department and a very meticulous, methodical worker, but not with the brain of Dr. Mendel. Dr. Mendel didn't do completely well in research himself because he came up through the ranks of the classics. Mm. But now I reaped his beautiful knowledge of how you write up things. I wrote my thesis under him. But I went back and learned how to do phosphorus despairingly. Oh my, it was a burden to find somebody that would teach me how to do a phosphorus determination. I went all back through those experiments, running a control now. But I finally finished off. The results were the same. It hadn't depended on the phosphorus, but I had to prove that. Okay. But now it came to writing. And I was the despair of Dr. Mendel. I couldn't seem to put pen to paper. I came up with the most miserable, scrawny kind of remarks about my results. I don't know why I did so badly. I'd written up articles to be published before I went to Yale. As a matter of fact, there was one hilarious session at our journal club, we'll call it. He called it something else. When one of the men chose one of my published articles to review for the journal club and criticized it all over the place, made me very funny in this presentation. So I'd written up material. His hilarity was unjustified, but anyway, I had to take it.
Were you perhaps just afraid? Intimidated by the whole?
I think maybe I was. I wanted to please Dr. Mendel now after having treated him so badly. And he apparently forgave me. I wanted to stand well with him. But I just couldn't seem to make it start or go. I was a failure as far as Dr. Mendel was concerned. So he finally said, "You talk very much better than you write." He said, "Your presentations in our journal club have been fine, just unusual." And I had given lectures. I loved oral presentations, and so I had given lectures on nutrition over the town of New Haven. I had accepted things like that. He said, you're quite outstanding. So now you are to hire a Yale man, advertise for one in the local paper, the college paper, get somebody that will take dictation, and talk to him. Then he will transcribe these notes. And it really did go better. I could talk, and this is an easier way than if I had been required to write all this down. So things went better, and I remember the thrill that I had when once he took what I had done in the interval between our conferences. He took it on the train to some important meeting he was going to and mailed me back a little note torn from a piece of cardboard. And it said on this little piece of cardboard in my, I think it was a special delivery letter, and on this little piece of cardboard, he said, "I think this is going better, don't you?" That was all the note, but oh, that was so encouraging. So I had this very fine contact with Dr. Mendel at the end. Dr. Smith did come back, and I had to rewrite some parts of it because he didn't agree with Dr. Mendel as to how it should be presented. So I had to rewrite some of it, but essentially it was Dr. Mendel's supervision. So that was very nice. So I was added to that in his office. When I first had my first interview with him, I looked at the row of theses on the shelf above his desk and recognized a number of heads of home ec departments whom I had known and did know. But there was a severe jolt in store for me, because here was the thesis of a very important individual that I had met in the course of official committees and things like that, Dr. P. Mabel Nelson from down along somewhere out in the West, inscribed in gold letters on the back of this Ph.D. thesis. It said, "Precious Mabel Nelson," on the back of a Ph.D. thesis. Her parents, she was an only child, she had come late in their marriage, and of all the things in the world, she was precious. And so she was christened officially and had to carry it for life, Precious Mabel Nelson, as head of a department But to the world in general, she was known as P. Mabel Nelson. Mm-hmm. And only people that looked at this shelf of Dr. Mendel's death knew. So I was added. My thesis was added. The PhD was the oral. Mm-hmm. Was not very enjoyable. I didn't mind it as we did it at Wisconsin. I thought that was the way it would be. But lo and behold, at Yale, it is a public function. Anybody may come who pleases. There were kind of settees along the side of this room brought in for any of the public that wanted to come. And you better believe the undergraduates or the ones that were working on their doctor's degrees came and made faces at you from those. From those seeds, so that was quite a trial. So there were a lot of local customs that I had to get used to. When we lined up for our commencement procession, it took place in the old way, that encircling the chapel. So we went along the exact pathway that the ministers, you see, the Yale had been founded for training congregational ministers. And I remember a great aunt of mine had written to my mother, "What in the world did dear Helen want to become a minister for? I notice she's gone to Yale."
That is funny.
So we went in this same exact pathway around that the minister had gone. My wondering eyes, when I crossed the campus one time, beheld the mayor of New Haven arriving in an old-fashioned carriage drawn by horses. He was wearing a cocked hat. The men with him were in cocked hats. They got out of this carriage. I stood with open mouth looking at them. It seems they were recreating, as they always did on that date, always something, some occurrence of Benedict Arnold was created on the campus. And you can't believe how odd that looked. The things that New Haven had done or Yale had done were always done then, forever. Well, now where, what was you?
Well, after that, I know you came back to the University of Wisconsin as an associate professor in 1928. And I thought it might be interesting to hear about what was going on at the time in the home ec department, and something about the relationship perhaps between that department and things like agriculture or chemistry.
Well, Miss Marlatt was still the head. It was only a department. She was the head of a department. There's a little bit of history that I thought was amusing. In the early days, Miss Marlatt had her department in Ag Hall, on the second floor of Ag Hall. Dr. Peterson's desk, as well as that of Miss Marlatt, was placed in the general classroom on the second floor of Agricultural Hall. Dr. Peterson used to describe with great humor the chills that ran up and down his spine when he first began lecturing to the class in the imposing presence of Miss Marlatt, seated at her desk in the same room. Well, that picture changed. She now was in the separate building that had been meant for just her, but was changed. Somebody got up on the ladder and changed the inscription over the door to be extension and home economics. But she was there, and she gave me all kinds of deference and accommodation and encouragement. She still was an exceedingly severe person. Criticism more than any encouragement was her way of proceeding. But I had ceased to be so afraid of her as I had been in the earlier days, because her attitude had changed somewhat, and she was just delighted to have me share with anything I could with the departments around. So we were not allowed to have home economics. That was the graduate school, and its supervisors, where home economics were was belittled and really hated. This book about what's his name, who was the head of the graduate that you said you had a copy.
Slichter?
Yes. Slichter just despised home economics and Miss Marlatt. And so from that kind of a source, we were not allowed to have PhD candidates, you see, because we were only a department and a despised department. I wasn't afraid of Dr. Slichter. I knew what his slant was. I had to have a good deal of commerce with Dr. Slichter, but always with an atmosphere of being very much belittled. But I can remember so well, it was up here at Brittingham that we had a reception, and he had it at his own house. Dr. Slichter had this reception at his own house to honor Dr. Steinbach for having founded the Alum Research Foundation and so on. And so Dr. Steinbach asked if he could take me there. He knew of this feeling of being belittled, and he thought maybe he'd better protect me at that reception. Well, we got to the reception, and Dr. Steinbach could hardly hold in his merriment, because Dr. Slichter was the most appreciative host to me. Oh, the kind, wonderful things he said to me. And Dr. Steinbach confided behind his hand that Dr. Slichter, whenever he had a reception, got riotously drunk so that he could he could say these nice things that he never could say if he was sober. So I was a test case, you see. He couldn't have said meaner things if he'd been, even as a host, if he had been sober. But he was a very fine host. Well,
what underlay his opposition? Was it similar to Hart's? Didn't like women, and women were...
No, because Professor Hart was all great-hearted to us. It was only that he didn't hire women. That was all that Professor Hart had against us. Oh, he was just wonderful.
No, I understand that, and I didn't mean to make that as a general statement.
No,
against
so
him.
That wasn't the basis of it at all.
But what was Slichter's opposition? That's
well,
what I mean.
he and the other people in charge up there of letters and science were jealous of anything. They were jealous of agriculture in general. We had the FAT test. We could get any amount of money from the legislature that was made up of farmers. It was a bitter rivalry. They hated anything that had to do with agriculture. And home economics was even more a training.
Was it that it was not academic enough? Didn't seem to
not
fit into
academic.
A university?
Miss Marlatt was quite academic, and so she had us select a good many things from the hills, we called it. But it was like a trade school, you
mm-hmm.
see. To them,
sure.
It was only a trade school. Those people did cooking and sewing. Well, it was much more than that. But they never got over the idea. And so they didn't want to have the university smirched with a trade school reproach, you see. And so they never got over the idea. And Miss Marlatt was timid for all that everybody was afraid of her. She was afraid of other people, too. Anybody in authority, she was scared of. And so she didn't push her claims as she should have. I tell you, they had waited for Mrs. Zewell to
That's
push
just what
the
I was
going to
ask.
Mrs. Zewell wasn't afraid of anybody. The little Scotch woman, she just had her courage right up to the fore. And so things went entirely differently when Miss Zewell came. But Miss Marlatt was afraid. She didn't push her claims. And so we weren't. Well, what I started out with was that we were not allowed to have a PhD of our own until Dr. Albion had his hand in things. But in all those years, when I was doing research, very respectable research, it was published in the best journals. The people that did that were the my students that did that were allowed to have only a joint major. So I had to get somebody over in ag chemistry, in the chemistry department, in bacteriology, in all these. They were great friends of mine. It worked easily. We never had any troubles about these. They would often let me do the lead in everything that had to do with the joint major. They were very considerate. I had no cause to bother about that kind of an arrangement. I liked it. It brought me in contact. Miss Marlatt liked to have me in the joined up with these other departments, learning things, picking up things along the way. The Dr. Fred taught me ever so much. I had a sauerkraut thesis with Dr. Fred. So,
A sauerkraut thesis.
You see, he had to do with fermentations.
Mm.
And so it was his friends in the sauerkraut factory that asked to have this proved. Well, he didn't have any space for guinea pigs. We didn't have space either, but Miss Marlatt wouldn't make space. And so I had a sauerkraut thesis with Dr. Fred. So my student and I went over to Dr. Fred's laboratory. I think I told you that Dr. Fred's laboratory and office were furnished with orange crates, painted a violent red. Red was his color. He liked to have students, that women that came to see him, dressed in red. Oh, he thought much more highly of them if they wore red. Red was his color. And so the orange crates were held his books, his theses, his manuscripts, all painted red. And there, even the orange crates were sawed off in half to make chairs, and they were painted red. But that was immaterial. The thing about Dr. Fred's laboratory was to see what utter devotion to one's research would mean. I hadn't any idea what a devotion would entail. It would entail that you wouldn't let your students have a radio set in the laboratory. Some of them worked better with very quiet music as a background. Background music was really psychologically good, but no. He saw to it that there weren't any such things around. It was part of your duty to come for half a day on Saturdays and Sundays. It was part of your duty to get there long before class time, check on your research. If you had a class that began at 8, you got there at 7 and saw that your research was all right before you went into your class lecture. Oh, there were things, of course, I couldn't quite adopt his way of having 3 and 4 hours of sleep at night because you worked at your manuscripts into the night, and then you got up and got to your, he got to his laboratory long before 7, but he tried to train his people to be there at 7. But he needed, and then you see the war came on, World War I, and he had responsibilities for that war. He thought he was carrying that war on his 2 shoulders. And he had even less sleep. He got along all right, but he went to Washington, but came back to Madison, to the university, carried both things for the war effort. Miss Marlatt left for the war effort and had her committees there in Washington. So it was a time of a good deal of effort. So I had many of these contacts with other laboratories. But Dr. Fred, to have his contact, he had what he called a Bible. He laid it out and said, "This is our Bible." And in that they inscribed or bound, it was a great big volume, and they copied references. They got references. Of course, there weren't so many references as there are now, but he had every reference that had ever been published to cabbage or sauerkraut. He had reprints of everybody. He had everything that belonged to that, and that was the Bible. A thoroughness that I never had dreamed of. So I began to try to imitate him in these ways. And so I got a great deal of my education from Dr. Fred. He was just wonderful. He was a very appreciative. He was, of course, a Southern gentleman with all the courtesy that goes with that. So it was a liberal education to work in his laboratory. Well, where are we?
Well, it's kind of open. I imagine with such different personalities as Miss Marlatt and Miss Zuhl, that there must have been some interesting goings-on between them in that department.
Well, yes, one of the very first was when Miss Marlatt was relinquishing her jurisdiction, but came back to see if the things that she had hoarded so carefully for the museum were being taken to the museum. She had things like an old coal-burning cook stove. She had things like that. Miss Zuhl had accumulated them to be taken to the dump out by the front door. Miss Marlatt nearly broke down and cried. She had kept those old things, the old treadle sewing machine, the coal-burning cook stove, utensils that couldn't be ever reproduced, the old flat irons, things like that, and they were to be taken to the dump. Miss Zuhl was for the latest in everything. I had an old a cook stove that was just irreplaceable up in my laboratory because it had gentle heat. I could dry things in it. I could have a heat that didn't vary in that oven for a great many of my experiments that needed it. It had a high oven so I could stand and read thermometers. that was taken away, and I was given a modern with great pride. Miss Zuhl showed visitors how I had been getting along with a poor, old, broken-down thing. She was the first one that had equipped me as I should be equipped. I had to get down on my knees to see into the oven. Nothing was right for my use about this hideous thing. Well, you see, the viewpoint was just utterly different. But that is why I gave up. I have a record, kind of interesting. I haven't all of them, but I have a few of them put together. I concocted a letter. Miss Dr. McCollum had said to me, "Now, you are retiring. Now you must write the history." He had a great respect for Miss Marlatt in our department. He said, "Now you must write a history." And so I concocted this letter that I sent out everywhere that admitted that it was Dr. McCollum that had suggested it. Mm-hmm. And I invited everybody to write in their reminiscences of the department as it had been in the past or was in recent times. And I got quite a file of letters. I have a few of them that I have reread, and I'll turn over to you. And there will be many more when I can locate them in my files.
We'll but just keep these at the archives then.
Yes, okay. Yeah. They may be thrown out.
Oh, it no, may be they that won't they be thrown aren't, out.
It may be that they aren't of enough value, but as I look them over, then I will turn them over. There will be many more.
Yeah, we'd love to have them. Now, these are then from, well, you wrote the letter on December 8th, 1960, so most of them will be early 1961.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
They will be along there.
Well,
what I wanted to say was, I got this great file of letters. Everyone was inspected. I had them come to the Department of Home Genomics. Everyone was inspected and read by Miss Zuhl, sometimes with great distaste.
Oh, really?
For reminiscences about Miss Marlatt, glorifying her. I knew that as I would write this history, it would be mainly in praise of Miss Marlatt, mainly to do because Miss Zuhl was quite recent. As the years stretched out, it would be much more to do with Miss Marlatt's department than with Miss Zuhl's School of Home Economics. I would have to have it typed down in the office. It would be wormwood and gall to Miss Zuhl.
Sure.
It would simply cross off the friendly relationships that I had established. I couldn't do it.
And you couldn't do it.
It would be just a terrible experience for me. So I bundled them up and made them at the next meeting of Home Economics. Where they have, at commencement time, they have a reception and a meeting, and I was appointed speaker. And I took out just a few things and got some old-time pictures and made a talk about the history of home economics that I said, this is it, this will do instead of my written thing. And so that was that. That was all there was about it. And so I have these, and they are historic, they are interesting.
Yeah, we'd love to have them.
So there will be more, but I need a secretary. My files are very poor, so I will.
It's right, I'm sure we could probably, if you wanted, have somebody from the archives help you with that.
No, it wouldn't be anything anybody could do but myself.
Okay.
So I will have more letters from Dr. McCollum. I will have this and that.
Great. Just a few more questions on this
yes.
very topic which
yes.
you brought up. Was Ms. Sewell's ill feelings, let's say, towards this project more directed towards the positive things that were being said about Ms. Morlatt, or the fact that Ms. Sewell was being ignored?
No, it never got to that. I said that these letters from people came through her hands.
Right, but she read them.
Yes, but there wasn't anything on the surface that I could quote at all. It was only the feeling that these were not especially precious to her.
Sure, I understand.
No, there wasn't anything outspoken.
What I meant, I actually...
No, there wasn't any way of my finding
what it
was that made a certain feeling. See, there wasn't anything that I could point to.
Sure. It'll be interesting to look at the letters, though, and try to figure what it was.
Yes. Well, I may have assumed more... It was my own feelings of how it would be received. Maybe it wouldn't have been, but it was just a task that I don't write very well, and it just looked like a terrible task. Another thing is that with my training in science, it would be just suffering if I couldn't verify everything I put in. Sometimes it would be that would be interesting, but I couldn't verify it. Well, that would be just terrible to me, to write up something and call it a history that I couldn't verify. That's part of what made it just so impossible to me. So, altogether, this is all there is now of that, except that I have here that I have rescued a history that started out to be a history of our honor society, Omakanu, but has a good many things about how the old department in the very earliest days. This is precious because I don't know where it came from. As I read it over, I can't remember ever having seen it before, but it's very good. I turn that over to you.
You don't know who wrote it?
No, I don't. It isn't signed. Ms. Coles herself doesn't have the least idea who wrote it.
Well, thank you.
So, but it's very good. And this, of course, this goes on. This, of course, fits in with that about the very earliest time. I don't think that's included in that about being in Ag Hall.
Okay.
And then I was on a committee. Well, now this is a little touch of history, too. Miss Marlatt's precious course that she taught, humanics, and then she tells what the word means and so on.
Thanks.
Then Nellie Kedzie Jones was, oh my, she was so important because she was Miss Marlatt's teacher back in Kansas. Mm-hmm. And so when Miss Marlatt had a department at all, the first thing she did was to send for Nellie Kedzie Jones and have her the extension part of the department. And so as she was a picturesque, she has left her imprint in so many things. And this is a little write-up of her. And then I was in a committee that was supposed to get up a little more information, and that is included in this. And Ms. Sewell says, I found this in my folder for Home Ec 109. I thought you would be interested in it. Please return when you have finished with it. Well, I knew she didn't care one hang.
Right.
So I never returned it. And then here is a very interesting little write-up by our Betty Cass. Betty Cass, you probably don't know. Betty Cass wrote a column in the State Journal, Day by Day, that then it was bound into volumes. I have many of those volumes, but this is a very picturesque little account that she wrote.
Oh, I do remember that. I've seen things of hers,
yes.
Looking at old issues of
the
journal.
Yes, the old issues.
Yeah.
Well, this was about our department. My Edith Clarine, I think I have mentioned Edith Clarine as one of the notable. Student that I had. She was from Sweden. And I have a picture of her. And she took her thesis with Dr. Steinbach and me. And when she went back to Sweden, she became the foremost woman of the year. She had all the hospitals in Sweden under her charge. She wrote the menus. She equipped all of the departments there and was the foremost woman of the year, so designated by the ruler of Sweden, whatever. I don't know what was the ruling thing of Sweden, but she was it anyway. Mm-hmm. She was a most amusing person. She was superstitious. It really was very nice how her superstition was stronger than her science when it came to her oral examination. She came early and took the little good luck woven thing that she had woven in Sweden of straw and took out the a volume from the topmost shelf of the bookcase, put this little good luck thing in, and put the book up again because she wouldn't have faced that oral exam. And she had an intimate friend that had failed to get his doctor's degree in Sweden, because in Sweden, if in your final dissertation there is something that is quoted even mildly and doesn't have the source of where you got that statement in it, then you begin again on your doctor's degree. And this friend of hers had come up to his doctor's orals. They had found in the dissertation one thing that he hadn't quoted the source of. And so he went back, took an entirely different department, and worked from the beginning up through 3 years. She thought there would be something found in her thesis that would put her back to the beginning again. So the little good luck thing was up behind on the top shelf. Well, it was really amusing to have her. I forget what that was in apropos of.
Let me just turn this off because it's almost over and I'll just turn it over. Back to the university. Let's see.
Well, that designates a good deal.
Yeah.
My life. This is an interesting thing that you may take along. This was Miss Marlatt's father that owned the farm that included the Kansas State College in his farm.
Uh-huh.
The rest of the farm has now been made with the old farmhouse. Mm-hmm. Miss Marlatt's home has been made into a park now so that it is preserved. Now, what aspect this about indicates my research? I was left entirely free and encouraged to go on. It had for a doctor's degree, I could give a master's degree, but for a doctor's degree, it had to be in combination with some other department. So that was my life. There were undergraduate, for a while we had to have undergraduate theses too, so I had to manage those, and they did some very respectable work as seniors in home economics.
How did you get interested in antivitamins, the concept even?
Well, I believe it began with Dr. Dr. Mendel. You see, I finished up my thesis with Dr. Mendel. And you see, I had fed egg white and had obtained certain very queer symptoms. Well, they were very, very striking. And that's why he made me repeat to see whether all these striking symptoms were from phosphorus. Well, it just happened. It just happened that a woman in England had observed the same thing as that I was observing, and she and Dr. Mendel were in very lively conference by letter between England and New Haven. See, it was this kind of a very striking abnormality.
Yeah.
And so I worked for years on that after I came back and found, I made the original observation, but I didn't publish fully, so the credit went to somebody else. That was all right with me. I didn't care because I was fixed in the literature as having discovered that something was being abstracted by the egg white in the digestive tract. And so that was kind of an anti-vitamin, if you take the broadest sense. It was later disputed that it had to be in metabolism for the anti part of it, and this was in the digestive tract, but that was only just a little technicality.
Sure.
I guess I am getting mixed up. I guess before I went to Yale, I guess my other work, oh yes, that was before I went to Yale, there was Doctor's Alvium really tipped me off. He and I had many conferences. He was a very companionable kind of person. Mm-hmm. And of course I had links to his department so much. And there were many friendly things that we conferred about that weren't our students. And so I was in very close touch with him. I was always allowed to have a carbon typewritten copy of any address that he gave. So when I knew he'd been off at any symposium giving an address, I'd go over to his office.
Sure.
And ask him for a copy of that. And then he would expand on the symposium, on whom he had met. And he said, this is an interesting thing. He said, I came back on the train I came back on the train as a seatmate with so-and-so, who is a very illustrative person. And we were talking about my former student's work in Washington in the Department of Agriculture there, and he found that you couldn't make an assay of yeast. Now, you had to say how much vitamin was in yeast in order to advertise it as containing thus and so. He found that you couldn't make that assay on fresh, moist yeast. And this, I think it was Dr. Wilder of the Mayos that said, Dr. Wilder of the Mayos was a very great friend of Dr. Alvium because they were both on the National Research Council. That was a wonderful group of scientists that decided about the standards of what we would need for our intake. Oh, it was a very prestigious group of people. And Dr. Alvium and Dr. Wilder were great friends on this. And so I think it was Dr. Wilder that said, isn't it too bad that we can't test this with human subjects? And Dr. Alvium wasn't passing it on to me, but I said, well, why can't we? I'll take that right home and begin work tomorrow on that. He didn't mean it as handing it over as a task, but it wasn't any good for him. He didn't have human subjects in those days. He did later, but...
Excuse me, when was this approximately? We can add this in later, you know.
Well, it was written up. You should have a full set of these research things, and it was published in that.
Oh, okay, I'll look it up in there.
And so I took that up as my topic, and we just did yeast and yeast. Undergraduates could join in that as subjects. We found that the yeast cell was so resistant to the digestive tract that we could plate out after the thing had been through the digestive tract. We could take some of those feces and plate out live yeast cells.
Really?
The yeast went right through. We knew from Dr. Fred's work and Dr. Peterson's, you see, they were in the same office, Dr. Fred and Dr. Peterson. Dr. Peterson particularly had to do with studying yeast, and we knew that yeast was just ravenous to take up the B vitamins from anything around it. And so that gave the hint. And it was true that if I fed a given diet, the output in the urine, which showed the metabolism of vitamin B, was quite high. But if I fed yeast at the same time, the output from the person went down, down, just plummeted down, just daily, so that we could even get a few symptoms of lack of vitamin B because of the feeding of the yeast. Well, the yeast company were just red.
I'll bet they were.
Oh, my. You see, they were getting a great deal of their revenue from persuading the public
to eat raw yeast.
They called it a raw yeast cocktail. And it was really universal here in Madison. And oh my, was that yeast company. Were all of the yeast companies just on their ear. And so I was invited to go and present my case along with the yeast companies at a very prestigious meeting near Baltimore. It was an old club that we used. It was the research group that Dr. McCollum was quite prominent in. But this came from another set of people, this invitation to come lay my case before the prime researchers of the whole United States and be defied by the yeast companies. And so we went round and round, and they wouldn't agree to any of the evidence that I presented. But
they couldn't counter anything, though, could they? Really?
No, but they could interpret. Oh, that means so and so, and they would interpret it as the exact opposite of my interpretations. Mm-hmm. That yeast was still doing you just a whale of amount of good. And I can't remember how that argument went, but oh my. Well, then it came to my attention, a former pal of mine, who, as a matter of fact, had come in that same 1913 summer session. A small group of us, I think there were four of us women, that went to this summer class of Dr. McCollum's. And she had done research for the yeast company, and she had called the attention of the yeast company to the fact that her rats did not get on so well with that raw yeast, that you could not assay that raw mm-hmm. yeast. It was not doing what it was supposed to do, and they blotted it out. They wouldn't have anything to do with it. They canceled something she'd written up for publication. That was withheld. And so the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Food, not Food and Nutrition, but Drugs, the Department of Drugs there was headed by some Wisconsin man that I was quite familiar with. And I sent this evidence to them, and they had this girl go to, this woman, go to a bank with her books that she had been allowed to take home. I don't know how they allowed it, but she had taken them home after she had stopped this company. And the Department of Agriculture, Food and Drugs, had her take those books and deposit in a safety deposit box in a bank. Because if the wind got out, you see. And so then they sent one of their department down to the bank to examine those books.
Sure.
They found it was just a flagrant case. And so they confronted them with it. And so it came out that they threatened a good hefty lawsuit.
Sure, I'll bet. So, did this thing happen relatively frequently? In other words, when you're doing research in something as basic as a food industry or something like that, and you come across something that indicates that a certain food is actually detrimental to the health, I mean, do you encounter usually a lot of opposition from the manufacturers?
Oh, yes, if it is in commerce.
That's what I mean.
Oh, yes. Sure. Oh, yes, you do. The you see, I was then endowed by a yeast company over at Milwaukee because it looked as though I could show that if one became accustomed to eating raw yeast, there, I can't remember what hint, that seemed to be a hint from some other laboratory that if you became accustomed to this, you would get the full value of the raw yeast. And so they endowed me, hoping that at the very heart of the trouble, when it proved otherwise, they had to burn up $900 worth of their advertisements that were to be pasted on their yeast packages. It had cost them $900 to print those labels, and they didn't protest when the evidence, when they were, because Dr. Fred, Dr.
Peter,
everybody was in on that company, our own company here. They weren't dishonest. They didn't protest. They wanted the truth, but they wanted the truth to come along their side of the controversy. But when it didn't, they went right along with it. It is quite a usual thing to for my egg white work, I was insulted at the time of any of my reports. I gave year by year how this research was going before that prestigious group, the Biochemistry National Organization. And first, an egg department at Cornell, a poultry department at Cornell, stood up and said, "I can't afford to have anything wrong with eggs. I can't afford to have that happen," said he.
It's always the money issue.
And then the representative, who was a fine, she had her PhD, some of it was here at Wisconsin. She was a wonderful woman. But she was employed by, who are those people up at Battle Creek that believed in the natural foods and were vegetarians? Kellogg's?
One of those big cereal companies?
One of those big...
Kellogg's? General Foods? General Mills?
Well, it's one Oops. It's one of those very prominent Quaker. Ones. She came year by year and vouched that there was something else that was making this. It was not the egg white. She had tried to repeat my experiments, and they were not so. I was misrepresenting. Mm-hmm. She said, we cannot allow egg. We do not use meat, but we cannot allow anything wrong with egg white, she said. You see
That's
what
amazing.
I mean?
Sure I do.
Yes, and so I would point out each time that that she did not take the rats, she didn't deplete the mothers of the rats of enough of this thing,
sure.
and she didn't take the rats young enough. I pointed out exactly where she could repeat my experiments if she'd do so. So the University of Michigan had as the head of the University of Michigan a man that had got his degree when I did at Yale and was a very good friend of mine. He repeated my experiment exactly, and it was. And then the department, the food and drugs, were a little afraid. What if they were led astray, that it wasn't really
sure.
So that they repeated my experiment and found that I hadn't laid it on thick enough, that they got their subjects going down in their output of the vitamin, that it was even more than I had said, but they couldn't publish. They never publish results. I have done much results. Much of my publication has been where somebody couldn't publish their own results. The corn canning company, the pecanning company, they couldn't publish their own results, too commercial. But if they would endow me, and I would find the same thing that they did,
sure,
guided by their amounts that you had to feed and so on, I relied a good deal on their experiments. But it was my work. Then I could publish, then they could cite that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the food and drugs couldn't publish their results, but they knew that my results were correct.
I see.
And so they stood behind it and brought lawsuit, a very famous litigation in court that stopped all of this advertising, absolutely stopped in its tracks, advertising the cocktail.
The yeast cocktail? Mm-hmm. Do you think that such organizations as the Food and Drug Administration and so on are still too weak?
Yes, they could be protected by law because they know of a good many irregularities that can't be corrected until certain things happen. Then they can go in, and then they can only threaten, and the instigation of their lawsuits are slow things. They have to go through certain forms. By that time, the commercial company has changed its tactics just enough so that the evidence that they got, that they put through this long series, no longer stands. Oh, they're just hamstrung.
Yeah, because they always have been. I just thought of a date, of course. In 1906 was the passage of the first really strong food and drug laws in this country. Was it about this time that a kind of scientific interest in home economics really started developing?
No, I don't think necessarily so, because there weren't many centers of home economics that did research like we did. California, yes, but that was an academic department. Their clothing and anything like that was in a separate place over in another state college at the university there. Agnes Faye Morgan got her degree there with Dr. Mendel. And Dr. Mendel, when it came to placing me, I didn't finish my discussion of that, he got these openings that I could have had. Anything that he would recommend, they would be placed. So Agnes Faye Morgan had asked for somebody to work out in her department. And,
excuse me, this is when you got your PhD?
She got her PhD there with Dr. Mendel, but she was one of the departments in home economics that published. She belonged more to chemistry out there than she did to home economics, but officially she had the Department of Home Economics and trained people and got their PhDs. But when Dr. Mendel began talking to me about the openings he had, oh, he laid them out. He had a whole set of openings. He said, I have one here from Agnes Faye Morgan. Don't you go there. She'd kill you, said he.
She'd kill you.
So I guess she probably gave him some bad times. Oh, Agnes Faye and I. Miss Zool was scared to death of her. They were on committees together. Miss Zool could hardly breathe.
Well, she must have really been something.
Oh, she was
something.
Miss
Zool was afraid of her.
Oh, Miss Zool was just petrified over Agnes Faye Morgan. Oh, Agnes Faye Morgan and I were buddies. We went to the Russian meeting together, and oh my, we had a grand time. So Agnes Faye must have given Dr. Mendel quite a hard time. He might have had to walk the straight and narrow himself. And then he had a one from the University of Illinois. Now he said, this one would pay you two or three times what any of the rest of these would pay you. You would just be sitting pretty if you took that one. Don't you do it, said he. That doesn't have the prestige that Wisconsin has. And he mentioned some of the others. There was one out at Seattle. Oh, I can't remember the places I could have gone.
You're talking about now,
1928? 1928.
When you got your PhD.
I got my PhD. Right. And Dr. Mendel has all these home economics openings because he's an idol of home economics. And he believes in home economics. He likes them. And so he said, don't you take that Illinois one. Don't let money tempt you. He said, go back to Wisconsin. Associate with a campus that has real researchers. Now you see, fundamentally he respected Dr. McCollum, Professor Hart, Dr. Steenbach, all the rest. He did respect them. He had to scrap with them to save his own honor. He had to put up a good fight. But essentially they weren't so far apart as all that would seem to indicate in the literature. So he said, you go back. Work on milk or any of those favorite foods out in Wisconsin. That's all right. But whatever you do out there will be real research. He says, you go out there and you become a source of pride to me as my former student. So that headed me out beside my wish to come back out here. Why, I had his blessing, so there was no doubt.
Shall we end on that? I think it's a good time. We end on a very happy note.